The Profit and Loss of Dying by Clyde Aron. 1969. Davor Ert & Co., Publishers, 4900 Eagle Rock, Boulevard, Los Angeles, California 90041. Table of Contents. The Profit and Loss of Dying. Table of Contents. Preface. The Imperator Group. The Arrival. Channel of Communication. Transition. The Cause of Transition. On the Threshold. The Valley of the Shadow. Earth's Spiritual Smog. Gratitude. Spiritual No Man's Land. Orientation and Adjustment. Maturity. This Life and That Life. Preface. Immortality. Throughout the ages, man has been both awed and frightened by the prospect of his end of life on Earth. Most societies have encouraged man to believe in a life of some kind following death, but inasmuch as he had to die to find out about it, he has been confused, as well as frightened. It is very probable that the fear would have been greatly lessened during all the ages if a certain word had not unfortunately been chosen to describe man's leaving his physical body. That ill-chosen word, death, has been a stumbling block to all. It is a word that has come to be horrifying and fraught with sorrow, sadness and emotional outbursts because of the implication of the word itself, namely, that it marks the end of life, the absolute terminus of living. The lack of understanding, the weeping and mourning on the part of those who are left, has for many centuries made this occasion, in actual fact, a pagan experience. One of the definitions the dictionary gives of the word death is cessation of existence. You have heard it said many times that nothing is impossible. This is not wholly true. It is utterly impossible for you to conceive of your own non-existence. There are those who feel that this inability is all that is necessary to establish a basis for an acceptance of the philosophy of immortality. The reasoning is that anything it is possible for the human mind to conceive of, is possible of attainment. Whatever, if anything, is impossible to conceive of, ipso facto, doesn't exist. Therefore, since it is impossible to conceive of one's non-existence, then such a state does not exist. It follows that a continuing existence, that is, immortality, must of necessity exist. It has been very aptly stated that to be alive is to be immortal. Any discussion of the reasonableness of the concept of immortality should include the fact that all the historical cultures of the world have included a belief in some form of personal survival of death. Our Western civilization embraced this belief until 19th century materialism induced people to try to discard any notions about there being anything following death. This only augmented man's uncertainty and confusion and, in many cases, fear of the event. Yet along with the uncertainty and the fears, one of man's deepest longings has been for his own immortality. The great prevalence of juniors bearing their father's names, the many foundations and similar establishments bearing the founders' names, and various other efforts on the part of individuals to perpetuate their names all are evidences of a deep-seated longing for immortality. Is it not reasonable to say that one cannot long for something that doesn't even exist, has never existed, and will never exist? How else than through the doorway of reality and truth can such a concept form the basis for any longing? To say that something simply does not make sense is far indeed from scientific. Yet there are many individuals who are spiritually secure and content in having their acceptance of the philosophy of immortality based on the reasoning that nothing else makes sense to them. It simply does not appear to be reasonable to suppose that the short span of life allotted to one's earth existence in a vast sea of beginningless and endless time constitutes all there is to one's existence. Scientific formulas have their necessary place, but so does reasonableness, which can and must go beyond them. Quite possibly you have read of an emotional intellectual state called cosmic consciousness, which has been attained by a few individuals scattered through the pages of history. Saint Paul the Apostle certainly attained it, Socrates is believed to have been fortunate enough to have experienced it, the 13th century Italian poet Dante, Sir Francis Bacon, Walt Whitman. These are outstanding examples of many who have quite obviously attained this rare spiritual consciousness. And what is cosmic consciousness? It is a state of being, completely beyond the power of words to describe. Words and verbal language are inventions designed for communicating in terms of our three-dimensional world. Cosmic consciousness is a state far, far beyond human, three-dimensional consciousness. You can easily imagine, can you not, that an individual cell in, let's say, a flower, has its own rudimentary form of consciousness? How else would it have developed and grown into the thing of beauty which it is? Far above this single cell in consciousness are the lower invertebrates, or even the vertebrate genus of animals. Now you will find it somewhat difficult to imagine and identify with the consciousness of a chicken, for example. You can easily look down upon the chicken, but try to project in the opposite direction. Try to conceive of a consciousness as far above your own as yours is above that of a chicken. This is a crude analogy of what would be a small measure of cosmic consciousness. Cosmic consciousness is a realization of unity and affinity with the universe, with all that exists. No longer is there a sense of separateness, no longer is there a feeling that the universe and life are antagonistic to one's welfare. Those who have experienced cosmic consciousness do not live in it continuously. It settles over them like a dove of peace for periods of time ranging from the briefest moment to, conceivably, a few hours. During this time there exists a state or a quality which is completely non-verbal. It is beyond the farthest potential of descriptive words. Those who have experienced it have tried valiantly but vainly to describe it. What is the connection between this cosmic consciousness and immortality? One of its aspects is a release from time. Normally we are trapped by the present moment of time, and we feel that there is no way to free ourselves from this entrapment. Encased as if in a bubble, we are carried by the present moment along the now quiet, now turbulent stream of life at a rate of speed decreed by time, over which we tell ourselves we have no control. Among other results, cosmic consciousness releases the recipient from this imprisonment within the bubble of the present moment. He is enabled or allowed to experience a condition of timelessness, which, again, is utterly non-verbal and beyond description. One of the results of this release from time, with its concomitant shackles, touches immortality. Under normal conditions, operating in our present consciousness, we tell ourselves that we believe in immortality, and that our faith in it precludes any possibility of our discarding our conviction of it. But the recipient of cosmic consciousness no longer simply believes in immortality, he experiences it. He experiences it not as something he will attain at some distant time in the future, but as something he is living now. He experiences it with a knowing which is beyond words and beyond description. He experiences it in a wholly different order from that of simply firm belief and conviction, and this knowing cannot be transmitted. Those who have experienced cosmic consciousness no longer have any fear of what we call death. They realize that it is only a doorway into a different state of being. Another very important source of firm belief and conviction that the personality survives the disposal of the physical body is communication between the two worlds. Communication through the veil that separates life from so-called death has been known and recorded since time immemorial. Notwithstanding the fact that the 20th century is the century of wars and rumors of wars and world upheaval, it is also the century of the rediscovery of spiritual truth, far surpassing that in any intervening century since at least the beginning of the Christian era. Part of this renaissance has to do with increased communication between the two worlds. It cannot, of course, be said that an acceptance of interplane communication is a cause of a belief in immortality, because one presupposes the other. But granted a certain predisposition toward a belief in immortality, that belief is greatly strengthened by selective study of communication between the two sides of the veil. Just as one presupposes the other, each also augments the other. There are various types of interplane relationships, some of which are highly constructive, and some of which have their basis only in a lust for vicarious satisfaction or selfish motives. There are some whose spiritual eyes are open and who can see those from the other side. Thus, people have seen ghosts throughout the ages. Likewise, there are those whose spiritual ears are open and who can hear those from the other side and benefit from the messages given. Related to this, there are those who lend their vocal equipment to spiritually approved personalities from the other side, who can then speak through the individual still in the physical body on this side. This form of communication is the basis of the major source material for this book. The Imperator Group, if the idea seems plausible to you that a human personality survives the milestone called death, and remains the same individual, though in a state far beyond the present limits of the vision of most of us, then the next premise should be equally acceptable. Just as there are those here in a physical life who strive to be of service to mankind, so there are those who have passed through the veil of transition and no longer have physical bodies as we know them, who also aspire to the same ideal. Many individuals from this other side have dedicated themselves to serving the spiritual welfare of those still on this side. Many of these interests and activities are coordinated into organized work for greater effectiveness. Such an organization is the vast network of spiritual teachers from that other side known as the Imperator Group. Those who comprise this group have gone through the veil of transition and have dedicated themselves to service in spreading the light of Christ. Theirs is a labor of love. Some of them have not had physical bodies on this plane for centuries. Others, like Stainton Moses, Ernest Holmes, Florence Shin, and Dr. James H. Hislop, were on the earth very recently. The work of this group is under the general direction of Imperator, a great and noble spirit who was chosen by Moses and Elijah for the particular work of assisting in the spiritualization of the earth plane. These two talked with the Master on the Mount of Transfiguration, and they are still closely associated with Jesus in the great work. Imperator's work comprises seven spheres with seven great leaders, and each of these seven leaders has seven who work under him. Thus Imperator has command of 49 great souls, spiritual leaders, who are operating around, on and through the earth plane. Each of these in turn has a great company of workers, whose work covers the whole earth, who live and move and have their being on both sides of the veil of transition. The seven divisions comprising the Imperator Group's work are concerned with seven phases or aspects of earthplane living. One group or division concerns itself with the fostering and spreading of Christ-like love, the love of God, the love of man, compassion, pity and friendship. Another group consists of those whose work is that of inspiring spiritual teachers. Still another group concerns itself with the arts, assisting those who create in fields of music, painting, sculpture, languages, poetry and literature. Seven aspects, altogether, of constructive earth interests and activities are represented by corresponding divisions within the Imperator Group of spiritual teachers. The divisional group with which we are primarily concerned in this book is made up of those who dedicate themselves to the furtherance of wisdom, perception, intuition, consideration of cause and effect, reason, and the laws of life. It is the group around Imperator which deals with education. This group is under the immediate direction of a spiritual teacher known as Aramias, who has not lived in a physical body for so long that, like many of the other teachers, he is no longer identified by his earth name. It is from this group that there have come the information and teachings forming the basis of this book. You might very logically ask the question, since these teachers are no longer in physical bodies, how have their teachings and their information been obtained? To answer this question, we must go back many years to a time when a young woman entered into an association with Dr. Titus Bull, President and Director of Research of the James H. Hislop Foundation in New York, which concerned itself with scientific investigation of certain aspects of psycho-spiritual phenomena. Under the most meticulous tutelage of Dr. Bull, this young woman, now Mrs. Grace Ulrich Gores, was trained as an Imperator Group channel. Her rigorous training resulted in an ability to allow those whom we have called spiritually approved personalities to use her vocal mechanism for the purpose of channeling spiritual teachings and truths from the Imperator Group to the earth plane of existence. During more than 10 years of association with Dr. Bull, this young woman's work with the Imperator Group of teachers blossomed and reached full flower. For the past 40 years Mrs. Gores has been a dedicated spiritual teacher and channel for the group. The major portion of her last 30 years has been spent in the San Francisco Bay Area, where her work has involved both private counseling and group teaching, in which she has constantly made use of her highly developed channelship. The Applied Universal Metaphysics Foundation is an outgrowth of her work in group teaching. During weekly meetings of this AUM Foundation, one of the Imperator Group teachers speaks through Mrs. Gore's, bringing teachings of the laws of life, the laws of being, conditions on the other side of the veil of transition, and such other spiritual teachings as are appropriate to, and needed by, the group from week to week. The major contents of this book are taken from weekly tapes recorded over the past 8 years. Aramia's, the spiritual personality who is the leader at the group with which the AUM Foundation works, in speaking of Imperator and other great beings, to whom he is responsible, has said, "The brilliance of their personalities far outshines the sun. They have reached illumination, and it is a privilege to stand in their presence when we are sufficiently developed to do so. We, too, you and I, can know that the time will come when we will also stand in their presence." Chapter 1, The Arrival. It was closing time at the bar where Joe was a bartender. Somehow it had been an especially tough night and Joe was even more short-tempered than usual, cursing the inclement weather, his waiter who had quit, and his lot in general, as he quickly surveyed the scene before locking the door and walking out into the street. Although it was far past midnight, the traffic was still very heavy. And Joe was in no mood to be tolerant of the cars and their drivers as they passed him, seeming not to care whether they hit him or not as he crossed at several intersections. One driver especially Joe would have liked to tear limb from limb with his bare hands. And with his extremely powerful shoulders, arms and hands, he could have done it with little waste of time. He seemed almost blind with rage as he paused to hurl further invectives in the direction of the car that was already losing its identity in the heavy traffic. As Joe quickly resumed his steps toward the curb, he suddenly became aware of a car bearing down on him much too speedily. He also heard the screeching of brakes. Like a crouching panther, Joe sprang toward the curb. Time itself stood still. Everything stopped everything, that is, except that foreboding the awesome screeching of brakes, that hideous sound seemed to go on and on. But Joe was almost as nimble and agile as he was powerful, and he made it clear of the onrushing car. He thought. Nevertheless, a crowd of horrified onlookers gathered around a now limp and lifeless form. Joe was what the world calls dead. He heard some comments to that effect but brushed them aside. He clearly remembered the onrushing car, but inasmuch as he was sure he had gotten out of the way in time, the incident somehow seemed far away and was now relatively unimportant, in spite of his tremendous anger at the time. Joe went on home but was totally unprepared for what he encountered there. With a mixture of amazement and consternation, he discovered that for some wholly illogical reason, his family either could not or would not recognize him. And he seemingly could not make himself heard. As if that were not trouble enough, somebody got in touch with his family and succeeded in convincing them that he was dead. Their grief, together with his frustration at not being able to make them recognize him and convince them that he was alive, was almost more than Joe could bear. The whole world, and everybody in it, he thought, had suddenly gone completely mad. Furthermore, Joe was bitter. He was a man who was hard and cold, cruel and ruthless in his attitude toward people and toward life. He was obscene and sordidly uncouth, and his years as a bartender had hardened him beyond any mortal hope of decency and respectability. And now the whole worthless world, Joe thought, had suddenly gotten completely deranged and unhinged. Why in the name of God, if there is such a thing, which he doubted, had everybody, including his own family, apparently refused to hear what he tried to tell them, or even to recognize his presence? Joe's efforts to get through to his family and convince them that he was not dead remained futile. Filled with a mixture of anger and frustration, he started wandering around more or less aimlessly. He visited his old haunts, determined to find someone who would listen to him, whom he could convince that the rumor of his alleged death was totally without foundation. How could he be talking to them, or trying to talk to them, if he were dead? Joe's efforts and frustration both mounted. He did, however, begin to meet someone here and there who would talk to him, but oddly enough, each of these persons was having the same trouble Joe was having. No one else would talk to them, either. Out of a number of people he met in this way, he picked out two or three of his own kind and they wandered around, aimlessly. Then one of his new companions deserted him. At least it seemed that way to Joe. Together they were berating their fate and the sorry, sordid affair they called life. "You know," the companion said, "after all the things that have been happening to me lately, I think I must be sort of mixed up, maybe about a lot of things."
"Maybe you're mixed up," Joe retorted, "but I'm not. This whole crazy, miserable world we're in is mixed up plenty, but not me."
"Well, anyway," answered the companion, "I think I'm about ready to say that I wish there was somebody I could talk to who could get me straightened out." Joe glanced away for a moment. At that very instant, almost from out of nowhere, a stranger appeared and started talking to his companion. Where he had come from, Joe could not be at all sure, but there he was, and Joe's friend was listening to something the stranger was saying. Joe's first reaction to the newcomer was one of contempt and dislike. After all, Joe didn't like much of anybody, and he didn't care particularly who knew it. But then after a few moments, oddly enough, Joe's feelings toward the stranger began to change slightly. He didn't know what it was, but there was something altogether indescribable about the manner of the stranger. Joe wouldn't admit to himself that he liked him, but he felt that he could tolerate him a little easier than he could most people. After a while, Joe gathered that the stranger invited his companion to accompany him. Joe had no idea where they were going, but his companion indicated that, yes, he thought he would like to go. And that was the last Joe saw of him. This wandering and frustrated bartender continued to drift from place to place, making new acquaintances. But it was always the same, only those would talk to him who, like he, had heard rumors of their own deaths. He continued to spend quite a bit of his time trying to convince his family that the story about his death was obviously false. But they ignored him as if he didn't exist. The days slipped into weeks and the weeks into months, although Joe was not aware of this. To him, time was not something that was going somewhere, like a wheel rolling along, making one turn for each day or week or month. He was aware that it existed, but his concern or consciousness did not include any idea of time standing still or going backward or speeding rapidly forward. It meant nothing to him, although he could not have explained why, in terms of our calendar concept of time. However, about 4 months after Joe thought he had cleared the path of the speeding car, a new door opened to him. He was extremely suspicious of that door at first, as would be anyone with Joe's misanthropic background. After an especially grueling session of trying unsuccessfully to get some of his former cronies to extend to him some semblance of recognition, he became, very uncharacteristically, somewhat pensive. In this new mood, a most remarkable thing happened to him. He was momentarily conscious of a fleeting wish for help, a desire for something or someone who could help him find an answer to his dilemma. Suddenly, his pensiveness was interrupted by someone walking slowly towards him. "One have come in response to your desire for help," the stranger said quietly. Joe's first reaction was to give this intruder a hard punch with his fist to get him out of the way. He had always prided himself on the fact that he needed no help from anyone. His own two fists were all he had ever required. But this reaction was followed instantly by a new wave of frustration at not being able to talk to, and being totally ignored by those people he most wanted to communicate with. Besides, Joe noted with strangely mixed feelings, something about this man would have prevented him from using his fists anyway. "How can I help you?" the stranger asked. "If it's any business of yours," Joe retorted, recovering his usual insolence, "one wanna be able to talk to people, and have them talk to me." "Perhaps that can be arranged," the stranger replied, still quietly, unmoved by Joe's antagonistic attitude. "What do I mean, arranged? Since when do one have to arrange to talk to people? I've been quite a talker all my life, and nobody had to arrange for me to do any talking. Now this crazy thing has happened, and I keep on trying to talk to people, but nobody will talk to me, except a few guys here and there that are having the same trouble that 1 am. And would you like to talk to some people who are not, as you say, having the same trouble you are having? Well, cripes, what do you think? I wouldn't be wasting my time talking to you if one didn't, would I? If I arrange for you to talk to some people I know, perhaps they can help you find your answer," volunteered the stranger.
I don't need any help, Joe snapped. Except to find out what's going on around here. Can you tell me that? Come with me. The quiet, reassuring and soothing calmness of this man was wholly foreign to one of Joe's makeup. Ordinarily Joe would have brushed aside such a person with a contemptuous gesture and a few insolent words. But he was conscious of two motivating forces within him, almost as if he were two persons instead of the one he had always known himself to be, as if another part of himself, a strangely unfamiliar part, was saying, commandingly but calmly, "You are to go with this man. It is what you have been preparing for. Go, and do as he bids you." Amazingly, Joe trusted this unfamiliar voice. Almost unquestioningly he turned and followed the stranger who spoke with the calm reassurance Joe instinctively knew he needed. Chapter 2, Channel of Communication. At this point Joe still was not aware that he was dead. His consciousness therefore embraced only the three-dimensional earth plane. This new environment was totally unfamiliar territory and he had no idea why he was in a strange place instead of at home. And, worst of all, nobody could tell him why. Joe had no spiritual background for understanding transition and therefore no means of releasing himself from the earth plane. And so he very much needed an actual contact with people in physical bodies, not just another futile attempt to make himself seen and heard. Aramius, the leader of the Imperator group who had approached Joe when the first sign of wanting help was expressed, was in the process of making this contact possible. The experience would help to relieve the months of mounting frustration resulting from Joe's not being able to communicate with most people. Many times, too, as Aramius and others of the teachers has found out, persons on the earth plane could perform a service the teachers themselves could not perform on the other side. One like Joe who could not complete his transition, because of his ignorance of his condition and because of his ties to the earth, could be persuaded by those in physical bodies that he was no longer in a physical body that he had passed over from the earth plane. "I will now take you to some people who will talk to you when you talk to them," Aramius promised Joe. "But you must do just as I say. You must talk only when I tell you to talk." It was February 28, 1958. The members of the Applied Universal Metaphysics Foundation were assembled for their weekly meeting in Burlingame, California. The channel, Mrs. Grace Ulrich Gores, sat quietly and prepared herself for channelship for the evening, according to the method taught her by Dr. Bull. When Aramius approached her, she assured herself that it was indeed Aramius and not an imposter seeking to use her vocal cords. She realized there was a stranger with Aramius, but this gave her no concern. She allowed Aramius to use her vocal mechanism. "We have someone here for whom you can perform a service," Aramius began, speaking with calm assurance. "Every precaution has been taken to ensure that this channel has adequate protection. Be assured that everything is under our complete control." With this brief announcement, Aramius withdrew. After a few moments, from this same vocal mechanism that had been used by Aramius moments earlier, there came words having a distinctly uncouth quality. "Well, for cripe's sake, what am I supposed to be doing here?" Joe demanded insultingly. "What is this, the Ladies' Aid Society or something?" "No, it's not the Ladies' Aid Society," assured Leonard A. Worthington, the moderator for the group, who did most of the talking to Joe, "but we will be glad to explain to you what it is." Who said one was interested in a bunch of dudes like this gang? One didn't ask to be brought to this dump. "Maybe you didn't, but if you will," Leonard ventured, trying to find a starting point from which he could be of help to Joe. "One wanna tell you something," Joe interrupted, slightly less contemptuously, more interested now in his own problem and frustration than in the nature of the group to whom he had been brought. "One never get to talk. Oh, one talk a lot but people don't listen to me. Now you're listening to me, right?" "Yes, we are," Leonard assured him. "One don't know why," Joe continued quickly, obviously anxious to get to the point of his continued frustration. "Other people don't listen to me, and one try so hard. But they don't pay attention to me. They say." Here, in spite of Joe's innate contemptuousness, there was a note of contriteness and pleading for understanding. "My God. They say FM dead, and I'm not dead.